beginning, tomorrow it'll be an end. So nothing lasts forever, meaning neither your success or your failure lasts forever, right? The key thing is having that attitude of a beginner's mind and pushing yourself to do it over and over again.
That was Faisal Haq, and this is episode 15 of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome to episode 15. That's right, episode 15 of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. And if you don't know who I am, I'm your host. This is my show. This is the show where I sit down with fascinating people across all walks of life, and I use the lenses of risk, resilience, uncertainty, and randomness to uncover insights, get people to share stories, to give you things to ponder, to use, and simply to enjoy. The show is a labor of love for me. It's always going to be free of charge. The only thing I ask in return is that you subscribe, share, or like the episodes on social media. It really helps us out. I want to get into the show right away today because I'm really excited about this episode. I think you're going to enjoy this a lot. My guest is Faisal Haq, who is a best-selling author, a CEO, a technology entrepreneur, and many other things. He currently runs a company called Shidoka, and he is also a regular contributor to Fast Company and Business Insider. He has some wonderful articles, and he's written a couple of great books, actually more than a couple of great books. And I've been a regular follower of his for some time. His most recent book is called Survive to Thrive, which he wrote or co-wrote with Lydia Dishman. And it's all about the practices of resilient entrepreneurs, innovators, and leaders. And Faisal's own story at the same time is very interesting. He left Bangladesh at the age of 17 to come to the United States, where he studied and ended up forming his own company at the age of 22 and achieved a tremendous amount of success in his life, and then had to also deal with a huge amount of adversity. And as he did that, he started to make a number of changes in his life. And we'll get into all of that. We get into his story and his background, but we also get into a number of very interesting topics. We discuss resilience, gratitude, mindfulness, meditation, entrepreneurship, life paths and life trajectories, emotional intelligence, and systemic thinking. Of course, we talk about risk. We talk about living in uncertainty, overcoming adversity, dealing with fear, all kinds of things. I'm sure you're going to thoroughly enjoy this one. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further delay, here is Faisal Haq. Enjoy.
Okay.
So Faisal, thank you for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. And I've been reading your stuff on, particularly on Fast Company, and I really love your stuff. And I enjoy your books and your perspectives on things. And I wanted to talk about loads of things, but maybe first, let's just talk about your background. You have an interesting background. You came to the U.S. when you were 17, I think, from Bangladesh. And correct. I wanted to talk a little bit about that and what led you to this path.
First, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure being with you today. We all have different aspiration, and a lot of the aspiration develops when you are a child, right? Mm-hmm. So I was born in Bangladesh, and I was brought up in Bangladesh. Fortunately, I went to this great school called St. Joseph, which was a missionary school in Dhaka, Bangladesh. And so that kind of shaped my thinking in terms of, a global and world view. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate to have access to British Council. And at that time, there was a center called US Cultural Center, USIS, called the U.S. Information Services. So I used to, with my friends, hang around in those places and got very, very in tune with jazz and the whole American philosophical mindset and that sort of thing. Got exposed to a wide variety of English literature, both English and American literature. So that kind of formed my thought process and this idea of it wasn't as deep as it is now in terms of pursuit of happiness and freedom and liberty, but it kind of ingrained. And I grew up in a post-war liberation war country with a lot of famine and whatnot. But I was I was very fortunate to be in a middle class family and come out of an educated family. My father was an engineer and my family was very well educated. So that kind of prompted me to come here. But I didn't necessarily have the resources, so I had to develop a entrepreneurial mindset from the very beginning. So I applied to hundreds of universities in the hope of getting a scholarship after my TOEFL and SAT, and fortunately got a minuscule scholarship from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale for electrical engineering. So that kind of prompted me or encouraged me to take, quote-unquote, the leap of faith. And I found myself in Carbondale, Illinois.
It's a far cry from Dhaka. The winter's probably a little colder.
So the shock of winter came to me when I went from Illinois to Minnesota because I got a full scholarship for University of Minnesota. So that was that's when I got the shock of the winter, because I was in one of the coldest places in Minnesota, which is called Duluth, Minnesota. So that was interesting, departure from where I was, for sure.
I'm Canadian and grew up in Canada, so I'm well aware of what the winters can be like. But I really going from one extreme to the other, a tropical climate to Illinois and then Minnesota. I'm sure, we talk about resilience, but I'm sure that helped with your with your resilience at some level.
Well, it certainly did. And the ironic thing is, Ben, the climate change was the least of my worry or the struggle, because coming here as a student and really not having much of a support, having no family member, and top of all that, how do I survive financially day to day and pay my school bills and all that? It's a completely, you're in a flight or fight mode, right?
Right.
So I took the fight mode and I just don't give up on anything.
Yeah.
So I'm not necessarily, and I found out later in my life that whatever I've done, or whatever little success I achieved along with many, many failures, is from that resiliency factor, and it just this attitude of you work harder, you work hard as humanly possible and beyond, and that's how you survive, and then you thrive, right? So that's kind of the attitude.
That's ingrained
in me from the very beginning.
Some people talk about having a plan B, and then but sometimes you hear about actually it's better not to have a plan B.
Yeah.
And you just sink, put yourself in these sink or swim situations, and that's better, because maybe at the back, in the back of your mind, subconsciously, you're thinking, well, I can, I can always go to plan B, but maybe at some level this affected you and allowed you to achieve the different things that you have, which I want to get onto, but.
Sure. And actually, especially those days, meaning when I first came, this was 1985, I really didn't have any plan B. What would be the plan B? I mean, I came here as a student. I came here to study. And so you have to study, and you have to, and keep food on the table and keep clothing in your back, and you gotta go to the school. I mean, that is there is no plan right? Yeah, so, yeah. So I didn't have any plan B, but what I did is that I put myself to constantly, you know, nowadays is a very popular way of saying that is the hustle that makes you make things happen, right? So I guess I was hustling from day one, because I only had a partial scholarship from University of Illinois. So I that wasn't enough because, you know, I still had to come up with rest of the tuition. And, you know, I worked as a graveyard shift janitor when I came to UPS. That wasn't enough. So I had to find other, you know, an alternative way of doing this. So that's when I, after my first year of, you know, in electrical engineering, I started to look for additional scholarship. At least that covered my tuition, and then I would figure out a way to feed myself. So that's prompted me to go to Minnesota, you know, and then I switched my major from electrical engineering to computer science and management science, and I was fortunate enough to start working for a tech consulting company locally in Duluth, and that prompted me to come up with some pretty innovative software product that during those days, which you know, when this emergence of you know, the desktop was kind of emerging. And so I built this product, and I wanted to see whether I could leverage that, and that landed me 6 job offers from New York area. And so you know, I had 6 job offers, but I ended up going to Pitney Bowes, which is right here in Connecticut, which at that time it was a pretty cutting edge leading company. And that made me move to you know, Connecticut. And one other thing that happened is that while I was in Minnesota, I met my wife, who was part French Canadian, part Irish, but she's a Minnesotan. And so we moved here, you know, and I was 22 years old at that time. So that was the starting point of my career.
It sounds like you had, I don't know, an experience of, I guess that's a, what, 5 years or so, where it sounds like a lot of stuff was compressed in a very short period of time that, you know, maybe people have the same sort of experiences, but maybe over the course of 10 years or 15 years or maybe more.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, and some of them are, so that learning, if you want to talk about the learning, so it was learning, first to survive,
you know,
and learning about a different culture and environment and ecosystem, whatever you want to call it, and then learning about you know, my craft, which started at that time, which was technology. So learning technology and figuring out where the market is going. So at that time, Windows was just coming out. The desktop was just, you know, that PC Mac world just started to emerge in the market. So I got very interested in it right away. And so that gave me the edge, because there was not those type of skills. People were still, you know, the tech crowd was still kind of in the, you know, in the mainframe and those kind of environment.
So we're talking late 80s, early 90s kind of a time.
Late 80s. We're talking late 80s. All right. So, but that gave me the edge. And obviously, you know, I guess, you know, while I was doing it, I wasn't thinking this way, but it was taking a different path than most people would take, in the sense that you finish your school, you put together your resume, you do an internship, and then you get a job, right? So in my case, I wasn't doing any of that stuff. I went straight to a war, you know, for a local consulting company, selling PCs and putting together a network environment and writing some, you know, database codes and whatnot. And that prompted me to write the product. And instead of sending my resume, I just sent you know, a demo disc as a showcase of my you know, work.
It's the output, right?
It's not just output. Exactly. See, today, you know, this is many years ago, entrepreneurship was not as hot.
Yeah.
Technology entrepreneurship was not as hot. today, what would happen is that you would go straight from there to raising money and building a company.
Yeah. Everyone wants to be an entrepreneur nowadays, particularly the millennial crowd. And what's interesting is we always talk about nowadays we hear a lot about the rejection of the kind of templated lifestyle. So you get your undergraduate degree, and then you get your whatever, you do this, and then you get married, and you get happy, and people are rejecting that, particularly the millennial generation, but also people my age. I'm 43 now. It strikes me that you actually learned that lesson a long time ago, that yeah. One plus two doesn't always equal three, you found the ways around the so-called rules of the game.
Yeah, when I look at all this on the hindsight, so I took this unusual path, right? Yeah. If you want to call it unusual, but I yet ended up in a very traditional company.
Yeah.
I was offered work in a couple of Wall Street firm.
Yeah.
I didn't take it. Mm-hmm. I went to Pitney Bowes because I wanted to learn how Fortune 500 company works, more particularly how they innovate and develop products.
Sure.
I want to work in their R&D group,
yeah.
Right? So even though I started in an unusual path, I wanted to know how the traditional corporation works,
mm-hmm.
right?
And mm-hmm.
and which influenced my career, and is still influencing my career.
Yeah.
This intersection of entrepreneurship and traditional mm-hmm. corporate world and whatnot. So from Pitney, I ended up going to Dun & Bradstreet, which
yep.
is another traditional company mm-hmm. at that time. And then after a couple of years in Dun & Bradstreet, I started my first company.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, at that time, internet was just emerging. So I built this messaging software company.
Mm-hmm.
And I first got, I immediately got Chase Manhattan Bank as my customer.
Okay.
And then from there, I wanted to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
So I came across GE Capital, which is mm-hmm. in backyard right here in Connecticut at that time. And so GE Capital wanted to start their e-commerce business. So they brought me in with my IP. And in today's term, mm-hmm. I guess it would be considered acquihire.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't use those terms in those mm-hmm. days. So I went to GE, and that was another great experience because it's GE, so you
sure.
it's a very traditional company, and it was a very different company at that time because they were moving away from the manufacturing to a more of a financial powerhouse, and now, as you know, they have moved back to this very much of an industrial IoT or internet industrial internet device company, right? So I went there. So that was great, and that's where I got these great lesson on management, practices. Because the to run a machine, you need systemic thinking, right?
Yes.
So GE is a machine, right?
Yes.
So was Pitney Bowes, and so was Dun & Bradstreet. So the scalability and all that comes from systemic process and systemic thinking. That also influenced what I did later on. So after GE, I started my next company with seed funding from Gartner Group, which is, again, right here in Stamford, Connecticut. And first thing I did is got GE as my customer.
Mm-hmm.
I raised lots of money, and which on the hindsight was a very big mistake because I lost control of my company. venture capitalists, they took over the company and mm-hmm. they ran the thing to ground, and I got fired from my mm-hmm. own company. So I got very depressed and sat home and started writing my first book, which got published by Cambridge University Press out of UK,
mm-hmm.
which argued that these technology models are meaningless if you don't have a business model around it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, I started my next company, which was all focused on transformation, utilizing technology. And we had clients like PepsiCo and Northrop Grumman and U.S. federal government and in Europe French Social right. Security Service, you know, those kind of client. And I kept on writing. And, and, you know, and I never thought that I would be a writer, which I found, you know, initially I was writing to kind of articulate my viewpoint around management, innovation, and technology. But then as years went by, I became, you know, I found writing as a creative outlet, and I do that more as a creative outlet than anything else. And it had, it has expanded in many, many fold. You know, I now write about kind of a spiritual being and
I want to get into that as well. But maybe just you talked about the company that you founded and taking, you know, being taken over by venture capitalists, and you were sort of forced out of that situation. And maybe, you know, bring it back to this concept of resilience, which I, you know, did want to open up a little bit. I imagine that. Well, maybe not. I'm trying to put myself into your shoes, but I can't because, you know, I imagine that might have been maybe a first sort of major failure, if you like.
Yeah, for yourself. It was. Yeah. So because up until then, it was kind of like a pretty high ride.
Yeah.
You know, you're this college kid comes up with the product, gets $6 off, move on, et cetera, et cetera.
Right? I'm interested. And were you thinking that the world works linearly at that point? You know,
I was. And, you know, and you know, and then, you know, and even like you go to, you know, I go to GE. I start their first e-commerce business. I decide that I don't like GE, so I leave. I start the company, create another company, got seed funding. So it was kind of a linear thinking. So if you talk to any entrepreneur when they loses their company, whether that's by outside force, meaning that they were ousted or they lost it because of, you know, they couldn't take it to the next level, or even they sell out, meaning, you know, you exit. Like in my case, I sort of exited. To go to GE, you know, you feel a loss, you know, because you lose an identity, right? And especially, you know, that kind of, you know, unplanned forced situation, you feel a great loss. You lose a part of you, right? So now so you get depressed, you know, so which I did, and I didn't quite know what to do with myself. But it took me only 9 months to start the next one.
Okay. You know? And is that where you just sort of, you turn, did you have a sort of a series of introspective moments and said, well, I need to continue, or what was the...
In my case, the opportunity kind of presented itself. Okay. And at that time, I was quite popular because, you know, it was the height of internet. And I was running a business-to-business internet company. And there weren't too many business-to-business, e-commerce companies. So we were different, and I had a lot of offer pouring in from all sorts of places. So, I didn't have a loss of, confidence per se. Right? And I was still very young. You know, I was 26 years old. 27 years old. So I wasn't, you know, and you feel indestructible. But you feel of loss, and I had to kind of, and you know, I kind of had to reinvent myself. So it took me 9 months to do that, plus I wrote my first book at that time. So it was the best way to overcome adversity is you get very disciplined and very busy, right? So you kind of like shut down your loss, and you try to recreate a purpose, right? So if you let that darkness of a loss or darkness of a failure take over and focus too much what could I've done and all that stuff, then it will consume you. You will not be able to overcome it, right? So that wasn't too bad, you know. But what was bad later on when I started my next company, you know, we had 08, 09, and business kind of shut down, anything. And I still had, you know, I was middle of it. We had federal contract that kind of stopped. So all that had I think that had even a bigger impact than when I was 26, right? Mm-hmm. Now I'm like, you're talking about 12, 13 years later. Mm-hmm. So so at that time is when I started thinking about writing Everything Connects, and, mm-hmm. and which was like really going back into my mm-hmm. roots in terms of where I come from and the some of the learning I had when I was a child, because I was greatly influenced by where I was born and the literature and the culture, mm-hmm. the Eastern literature and culture, which is very much, looking for an answer from within yourself.
Yes.
In Western terms, it's called authenticity.
Yes.
In Eastern term, this is really about being devoted to finding yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So even when I was young, I was very much into those topics, but perhaps I lost it for 20 some years while I was chasing all these other stuff. So when I, one day I was sitting in Dubai airport, and that's when I wrote the outline for Everything Connects. Mm-hmm. And it kind of came to me that I really want to connect the dot in terms of where I come from and where I have come thus mm-hmm. far. Mm-hmm. But in the context of value creation and being innovative and kind of tie in, creating organization and teams and whatnot, you know, that point of view. So that was a great therapy, for many reasons. And that also kind of triggered this genesis of what I'm doing right now, meaning my current company, Shidoka, where I kind of felt that I really want to devote my next phase of my career helping other entrepreneurs, other innovators, mm-hmm. and other creators in two ways. I know how to write now. Mm-hmm. It comes naturally to me. So I want to keep writing. Whether somebody buys it or not, that's mm-hmm. not the relevancy. That's one, because it's inspiration and it's how-to. And if somebody reads it and finds something, mm-hmm. that's great, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one. The other thing is I know technology, so I'm going to create, I'm going to manifest my emotional intelligence with systemic thinking. That's what manifested the software platform that mm-hmm. I have created now, which I'm giving to the incubator, accelerator, and the other type of innovation hub or management consultant, so mm-hmm. that they can help people to scale those kind of entities. And there's a social impact element to it. So okay. that's where I am right now.
Okay, that's really fascinating. There's a lot of stuff that we can dive into. But just want to pick up on a couple of things you said there. One was this convergence between emotional intelligence and systemic thinking. I think my listeners probably understand what you mean by emotional intelligence. What about systemic thinking? What does that mean?
Right. So, you'll relate to this very well because of your background and you work for a large corporation. Systemic thinking is you can quantify it in multiple ways. One is that you need to make decision based on data. Mm-hmm. You need, because there is an accuracy factor. There's a, gut instinct is a kind of a emotional thinking, right? I think this is right, but you mm-hmm. still need to validate that with some level of data. That's one. The other part is that you need to follow certain level of flexible process. You don't want to be overburdened with process, but you still need to follow some level of process if you want to scale something, mm-hmm. right? And then the other part of it is that systemic thinking requires constantly evaluating impact of whatever that you're doing. So mm-hmm. it's a combination of assessing situation with set of validated data, establishing sure. some level of loosely coupled process or framework that you can follow, and then ability to evaluate whether you're really making an impact or not. So the mm-hmm. impact could be that I increase my revenue. Impact mm-hmm. could be that I launched new three products, right? Mm-hmm. Impact could be also that we created 20,000 jobs for $10 per hour, right? Mm-hmm. So So the definition of impact and value creation is very different for each person or each organization. I'm non-judgmental, so it doesn't matter to me what is your value definition is. Where I have come to in terms of conclusion that emotional intelligence gives you the, you know, the your inner and outer awareness, meaning inner awareness as a part, you know, in terms of who you are, and outer awareness is that, you know, the people and the ecosystem that is around you, right? How they feel, what their needs are, what they want to do, their aspiration, right? So if you can connect the dot between your, you know, who you are and how you want to take that and apply to what other people's needs are, that is what emotional intelligence and, you know, at the core of it, leadership is all about, right? Okay. So now if you want to take that leadership element and your emotional intelligence and say, look, I really want to enable others. People don't need me. They just need my thinking and I want to enable them. I mean, you know, like that's why, you know, we talk so much about things like Google or Apple because they're enablers, right? I mean, anybody can do whatever they want to do utilizing whatever they're using. So it's the systemic thinking is like quantifying and codifying and enabling set of you know, data and process and measurement so that other people can do things what they are focused on in a better way.
That's I think that's very profound because the particularly the emotional part because and I do want to bring this back to I guess your both of your books because I think or your both of your recent books. You talk about this whole concept of well I guess you know we talked about it, authenticity, knowing yourself, and you talk about that in terms of leadership. When you reflected, when you wrote, I guess Everything Connects, I suppose also when you wrote Survive to Thrive, did you redefine or did you realize that you were in the process of redefining your own definition of success?
Absolutely. You know, see, and I believe that, you know, we are just like nature, you know, we're constantly evolving, right? Meaning as a person, right? So who you are in your, let's say, in your teens and your 20s and 30s and your 40s and 50s or 60s or whatever, you're evolving because so definition of you know, success and even your authentic self changes, right? And
it's a human need to grow, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you have to reinvent yourself, right? I mean, you can look at it at a very pragmatic point of view that, you know, your skills, let's talk about like basic survival, right? So let's say if you want to be, let's say you're talking about your career, your skill sets 20 years ago versus your skill set today has to be very different. Otherwise, you wouldn't be thriving. You may be surviving, but you won't be thriving, right? So, but as a person, you also have evolved because you have had some success, you have had some failure, you have had some, a perspective in terms of what has happened to you. Your family might have grown. You have had some losses, family losses, financial losses, whatever. That all shapes our, you know, who we are as an emotional being, right? So it's constantly evolving. So the definition of authenticity, it's a journey. It's not like you get somewhere and you say, I have arrived. You never arrive. You are constantly moving and evolving. And that's the way it's supposed to be, right? And as you grow older and or you go through your journey, you realize these cliche statements like life is a journey, not a destination, right? I mean, when you're in, when I was in my 20s and, you know, unfortunately, I had quite a bit of success even in my 20s, right? So I didn't understand that. I know now what that means, you know. So you know, living in the moment is what matters, you know, and I know that very well now, you know, and you evolve.
And I think that makes it a lot easier to connect with other people.
Totally.
Because you can understand where they're maybe a little bit better, where they're coming from and what shapes them.
Sure. And it reflects in life and in work, right? Mm. Because what has happened today, world has become highly collaborative, mm-hmm. and it's highly decentralized, yet is very centralized. What I mean by that, because we are connected, and we are living up each other's ideas, we're not even working with people that are within our four walls anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So that requires us to be very much aware of other people's situation, which brings back this topic of empathy, right? So mm-hmm. you have to be empathetic in terms of where each person's coming from. I mean, and if you understand that, and if you try to force yourself to lead from that point of view, you'll be far better collaborator than, and you'll get more out of people mm-hmm. than you would do otherwise. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. You know, I mean, I had to learn that through my own journey. And so mm-hmm. right now, I relatively run a lot smaller organization, yet I run a pretty large organization in the context of I have more partners than employees, right? So, and they're literally, all over the world, right? And different time zone, different culture. Just like you and I are talking, we could be just sitting in my mm-hmm. living room mm-hmm. or in your house or in mm-hmm. my office or whatever, right? So that also has a, has an impact, right? So I think the winners, both from a personal reward as well as financial reward, will come from that kind of awareness and being mm-hmm. able to lead yourself and others with that kind of mindset.
Mm-hmm. Really fascinating stuff. I wanted to bring it maybe to some of the themes of the book, the Survive to Thrive book that you have out now, and maybe just talk a little bit about the theme. I really love some of the stories in that book, the going back to Helen Keller. I learned about Helen Keller when I was in grade school, but that is sort of I am, I have, I can. The way you've organized that book and the concept of resilience, maybe a little synopsis for people who are unaware of the book, I think might be really helpful.
Sure.
And maybe in terms of resilience and how that relates would be great.
Yeah. So first of all, as you saw, that all my books are in collaboration with somebody
else.
Yes.
Yes.
And I that's very much who I have become. Mm-hmm. I like to do work with other people.
Yes.
There are things I do solo, but in terms of books and stuff, I'd like to do in collaboration. So Lydia was my my collaborator, and so she and I thought of tapping into other people in order to portray this notion of resiliency, mm-hmm. And we wanted to portray different lives mm-hmm. and different journeys, right? So what we did. We interviewed a host of entrepreneurs, investors, innovators, corporate people, male, female, in different geographic locations, from different socioeconomic background and whatnot. And what we learned is that each person during their journey have adopted a different mechanism to develop their resiliency. Mm-hmm. Some adopted meditation, mm-hmm. some adopted laughter, some adopted leveraging their family support system, some adopted a particular ritualistic behavior. Mm-hmm. So in my case, if you talk about myself, I find more and more three things that helps me to be mm-hmm. develop a resilient, a resilient mindset. One is that I constantly push myself to do something better than what I did before. It's not a comparison with anybody else. Mm-hmm. It's not a competition with anybody else. So example would be If I wrote a blog, can I make it more interesting, right? Mm-hmm. Or if I designed this product, I'm still very much of a product developer. If I developed a product, can I make it more easier than it was before? You know, it's that kind of pushing and being dedicated to your craft, mm-hmm. because as you evolve your craft and as you become more skillful, that gives you confidence that you can conquer anything. Even like the fact that I do some fun stuff, like for example, I have become an avid cook. I love mm-hmm. to cook. It's an outlet for me. And I kind of constantly keep experimenting with stuff that I wouldn't do, mixing up things. And so again, it's not that I want to become a professional chef or I want to get into a competition or whatever. It's a confidence mm-hmm. that makes you think that, well, if I can do this, what is this? This is nothing, right? So that's kind of thing.
Yeah.
Second thing is that you try to meditate, and my these days my meditation is about being thankful and gratitude, mm-hmm. because if you kind of focus your meditation around gratefulness and thankfulness, it gives you a perspective, right? I mean, look, there are so many unfortunate people. Mm-hmm. Once you put yourself into their shoes, your adversity becomes nothing, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you and I could be a Syrian refugee right now, mm-hmm. right? Or you and I could be, you know, in somewhere where there's bombs flying all mm-hmm. over our head, right? So mm-hmm. so that's the second thing, mm-hmm. and the third thing is that you really become mindful about that particular moment. Like right now, you and I are talking about I am not thinking about anything else. It's you and my conversation mm-hmm. with you is what's most important. Mm-hmm. I'm not even crafting this conversation is what will other people think. I'm just having a conversation, and that's all that matters. Right?
Yeah.
So these three things is how I practice the resiliency. Yeah. But each person, if you read Survive to Thrive, you'll discover that each person has developed their own mechanism of mm-hmm. It's not better. It's not one is more effective than others. It is their own, and you have to find your way. That's really mm-hmm. at the end of the day, all this math. All we try to do is highlight how each person dealt with their adversity.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I mean, just as you've experienced on a long enough timeline, we will all encounter adversity, right? It's actually can be guaranteed. I'm a risk person, and I know that on the laws of probabilities, you're gonna run into some adversity in your life. So yeah, the question becomes how you deal with it. Do you have a specific practice for meditation that you use, or do you do something in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of evolved it in my little practice. So I do it two ways. One is that I typically wake up really early, and mm-hmm. and because you know, first thing I do when I get up early, I have a outside Zen garden. I go there. Mm-hmm. And I spend some time there, and I try to meditate, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's not a repeated mantra or anything. It just I try to clear my mind and try to express my gratitude. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's my thing in the morning. And then immediately after that, what I do is I make breakfast for my son, mm-hmm. and I find that very meditative. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And I don't do anything before that. Everything else starts. After that, so, but that sets the day for me, right? That kind of sets the day, right? So, and that lasts a while, right? I mean, that lasts the whole day, and it's like a affirmation, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. sort of affirmation, And then I also find, I find music as a great way of losing yourself and mm-hmm. meditation. I'm a big music buff, so I listen to music all the time, of all kinds.
Yeah, my own drug of choice in quotes is exercise and running. But I think we all have our rituals, as you say. I think one of the worst things that you could do is open your phone first thing in the morning and look at your messages and your Facebook feed or whatever, and you become very the world kind of starts to dictate you and boss you around a little bit, it feels yep. like.
Yeah, and you know, again, that's the other thing I have tried to develop now, whereby I don't do that first thing in the morning, and I do not do that before I go to sleep. I try to cut myself off by 6:30 or 7 at night. You know, it's just because it has an impact.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the downsides of, you know, our interconnected world, and you know, it's very hard to. I think neurochemically, when we see an email alert or something, it triggers something in the brain, or even a Facebook like or something that you know, our minds haven't really caught up to the technology on an evolutionary basis. Yeah. I don't think.
Oh, so that's where the discipline mindfulness comes in. So mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's been many, many studies now that says, I mean, you don't have to be a mindful, you know, mindful guru or anything. But the fact is that when you try to multitask, so this is a form of multitask, right? I mean, I'm talking, I'm looking at message, and I'm trying to write, and I'm thinking about something else. So that is multitasking. You know, I mean, multitasking is a most unproductive way of doing stuff, right? So, so if you say, "Look, I'm going to watch a show," and while I'm doing that, I'm not going to look at my phone. Mm-hmm. That is being mindful. Mm-hmm. Or I'm going to, you know, make breakfast, and I'm not going to look at my thing. Or I'm going to have dinner with my family, and you know, like it's in my household. Yeah. You're not allowed to bring your device at dinner table. But those little things help.
Yeah. So that's mindfulness. It's not some kind of, you don't have to go to the Himalayan mountains to visit a guru to be told how to be mindful.
You could.
Yeah. You could.
But,
for
average mortal.
Yes.
Living average life, which I consider myself an average mortal living average life. I find these basic things is what, if nothing else, keeps my sanity together.
Okay, great. I did also want to talk about entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
So I do think in many ways we're all entrepreneurs, whether or not we work for a big organization or on our own. What are some of the things in your experience that entrepreneurs don't get right, or perhaps don't think about when they're setting out on their entrepreneurial journey?
Sure. So it all depends on what stage of your life you enter entrepreneurship, right? Mm-hmm. So when you start early age, you know, there is advantage and disadvantage. Advantage is that you're naive, and you don't
think
about
unicorns you can set your own hours and
that stuff.
Gonna be rich.
And you know, your ignorance is truly a blessing at that time, because if you knew all the stuff that would go wrong, you wouldn't jump into it, right? So that's that's the benefit of starting early. Now, what happens as you grow older, you know more, so you are better prepared. But what also it does, you become risk adverse,
yes,
right? So you don't want to take a chance, right? So you're always looking for what's plan B, what's plan C, what's plan D, and you get into a comfortable zone where you don't want to, you know, rattle your comfort level. You know, you want to have that steady paycheck. You want to have that lifestyle, or you say, well, I want to know, you know, what's going to happen, you know, 10 days from now or 30 days from now. Entrepreneurship is all about unpredictability, right? Uh-huh. So. You just don't know. You know. So those are the pros and cons, right? So the first thing anybody who wants to become an entrepreneur, you have to adopt this notion that it's an adventure, it's a journey, and you have to have a beginner's mind, because you're gonna learn, you're gonna make mistakes, but you're gonna have to put it aside and take the next step and the next step. And the other thing that I would say, now that I know that I didn't know before, there is no end, there is no beginning. And it is so true. What you think is end is a new beginning. And what you think is the beginning, tomorrow it'll be an end. Mm-hmm. So nothing lasts forever, meaning neither your success or your failure lasts forever, right? The key thing is having that attitude of a beginner's mind and pushing yourself to do it over and over again. So what? You lost a company. Big deal. Mm-hmm. Start another one.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So what? Your last book was flop. Big deal. Mm-hmm. Write another one. You know. And that's the fun of it, because if you're creative, you know, then you get to do that all.
Yeah.
And by the way, you said we are all entrepreneurs, which is so true. Which was true more so maybe 100 years ago mm-hmm. or 200 years ago, because we were all you know, we were all exploring, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we had to find our way. There was no set path. Then we got into this notion of set path, right?
Yes.
What is happening now, because mm-hmm. of all this disruption, you know, speaking of Lydia, mm-hmm. she wrote a piece today on Fast mm-hmm. Company saying that okay. we're all going to have multiple jobs in
mm-hmm.
the future.
Mm-hmm.
You can already see that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you can say like, okay, I mean, you too, you said this is your, it's a, you know, what you're doing
yeah.
with me is a fruit of,
yeah.
you know, it's a project of passion.
Yeah, cypreneur, I don't know what you call
it. Whatever
one of those
you want
things.
To call
yeah.
it.
Sure.
And but, you know, already people are playing multiple roles.
Yeah.
You're VP here, you're CEO there, you're a board member there,
yeah.
you're a volunteer there. That is your multiple role,
yeah.
right? So,
yeah.
and that is increasingly a path, right?
Yes.
And the other thing that's happening is more and more people are looking for meaning of life.
Yes.
So,
yes.
so the meaning of life, it's not a millennial thing. It's a
yes.
human thing.
Agreed.
You know,
yeah.
mm-hmm. And so from that point of view, I think this, if you want to find what is the meaning of life, which is very unique and special to you, that means that you have to be by nature adventurous.
Mm-hmm.
And by adventurous means that you live in uncertainty, right? So
yeah.
you don't know what's going to
yeah.
happen.
Oh, so many good things in what you said there. I don't know where to begin, but there's so lots of wonderful stuff. There's that book that I was thinking about, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's it really resonated with me. And what you said, I think when we you're right, when people get a little bit older and a little bit more experience, you have to be careful, because you do become more risk averse.
Yeah.
And there's a thing called it's not just recency bias, but it's a bias that, oh, that was awful, I don't want to have to go through that again. Well, you know whether you want to or not, you may have to deal with that adversity as well.
Absolutely. You know, and here's the biggest benefit of beginner's mind, and so there's one is that it keeps you young, right?
Mm-hmm.
So age becomes a non-factor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that it allows you to relate to a wide variety of gender, age, and culture,
yes.
right? Which by in itself very exciting, because
yes.
you know, I mean, you look at everybody as a peer, which
yes.
I do. I mean,
yes.
It has no relevance
You can make a connection
yeah.
with a 20-year-old, and it's, you know, it's great.
Or 80 years old.
Yeah, and it's so much better, because when we have these titles, you know, next to our names, we start to modify behavior, or you know, for usually worse, not necessarily for better, and that doesn't create an authentic interaction.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct. So. But if you adopt that, you know, you're evergreen, right? So,
yes.
so you know, and if you, you know, if you look at authentic personalities, you'll see all of them are exactly
mm.
that, right?
Mm.
So they don't really care, and you don't have mm. to look at from a entrepreneurial point of view. You said athlete, you know, some
just
of your listeners are athletes.
Yeah.
Human
mm.
interaction. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I mean, whether that's an artist or
mm-hmm.
a musician or I'm a big fan of Jeremy Wade, you know,
mm-hmm.
that River Monster. Have you
mm-hmm.
seen that show?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I mean, it's a British guy, you know, who's
mm-hmm.
a geologist and finds this unusual species around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you look at Anthony Bourdain, I mean,
yes.
these are all authentic personalities.
Yes.
Right? They're kind of beating their drum in their own tune. You can't follow them, but they're
yeah.
very relatable to
yes.
any age group. Right?
Yes.
And musicians are the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was... you know, a few weeks back, I was at a Gypsy King concert,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they're gotten now
yeah.
older, right?
Yes.
But
yes.
I was looking at the audience, and you had like some 16-year-old listening to it, and then you got these, you know, some 75-year-old grandmother on the stage dancing at the same, you know, the same breath. It's very, it's a transitional, you know, I mean, it's transcendent, if you, you know, and it comes from that kind of attitude.
Yeah, that authenticity creates those connections.
Absolutely,
and you can do wonderful things when you have that.
Yeah, and it also comes from being non-judgmental about who you are and who are you with, and you know, and acceptance is a big part of it, right? So you gotta accept yourself first. Mm-hmm. So if you start, you know, if you don't accept that, oh, I'm getting older, or I'm so and so, or this and that. Mm-hmm. There's a positive and a negative aspect to it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of mindset goes back to that emotional intelligence as well.
Yeah, that's very beautifully put. Really, some great stuff. I could talk to you for hours about some of the stuff that you said, but I'm also, you know, being mindful of the time as well, and of your time. So probably get to wrap it up soon, but maybe a few things in terms of what's next for you. I mean, the way you just described that, it sounds like you're a very optimistic person about the future and where the world is going. And
I'm optimistic. I'm a positive person, but I also need to do tangible things, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not a, so my way of creating anything tangible manifests into through you know, creating new product or new service or. But what I have come where I am right now, it's more about enabling other people versus can I create the next big company or next big thing. It's a lot less about that.
So it's right? a lot of coaching and mentoring or?
Not necessarily because, you know, I mean, I'm you know, through my company, we've created this digital platform and those digital platforms are being used by other people to create their path.
Okay.
So because we are working with accelerator and incubators and innovation hubs, but I am enabling them so they can scale it. They don't need me. You don't need me to do it, right? So you don't need me as a coach or a mentor or whatever.
Okay.
That's where that systemic manifestation comes in, right? Mm-hmm. So I will always be about that. Mm-hmm. But with this undercurrent of my philosophical belief system, and so now all I care about is that not so much about creating the next big company or can I do this, can I raise money or any of that. It's more about can I enable others to make an impact. That's more important to me than anything else.
I'm thinking that there's an image there. I'm bringing back to the image that you had about you've got a small, maybe small core, but your partnership network, your collaborators, all of these things actually make it, you know, make what you're trying to do with your ventures sounds to me like even more powerful than if you had had an empire of
and what I realized about myself, and again this is uniquely myself, once upon a time all that was perhaps important. It's more about making impact than anything else. I've been fortunate, despite my adversity, I've been super fortunate to be able to do whatever I want to do, right? Mm-hmm. So it's my way of giving. I'm not Bill Gates. I cannot write $76 billion check, but I can give what I'm good at, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's all that matters.
Mm-hmm. It's a great way of for people to live and to be, I think.
Because, you know, we all have unique gifts that can give it to ourselves and to others, right? So it's the key thing is getting very comfortable and being getting happy about that gift.
And you have to spend a bit of time, you know, getting to know yourself and what you like, what you dislike, and that does, you know, that does come from experience and a bit of a bit of adversity and some
and maturity.
Setbacks and maturity, absolutely. But it does come, and I think we all eventually make a bit of a shift. Maybe not all of us, but just in terms of that external validation, you know, we have to put that to one side. You know, the car, the house, the job title, you know, the corner office, what have you. Although some people never let go of that, and they tend to be unhappy. But I think, you know, those that do can live very meaningful and happy lives, right?
Absolutely. And look, I mean, I can't, you know, and I didn't know this. Like, you know, when now, you know, somebody sends, you know, an email saying, hey, I read this piece from you, and it allowed me to do this and that, right? That I cannot express the satisfaction I get out of that. Mm-hmm. It's more than somebody sending me a half a million dollar check. And I mean that sincerely. Mm-hmm. And because if it made an impact in somebody's life that I don't know, I mean, I'm, you know, I don't know this person, right? So what better way to give some, you know, what, I mean, that's very powerful. And it's not, it is powerful for that person, but it is more powerful for me because it is satisfaction. You know, I can't explain it. It's a power of giving, you know, is, and if that, whatever you're trying to create, if it does have an impact, you know, you stop worrying about your own future and your own fear and your own uncertainty, because it you feel part of the universe, you know, and it's important. It is important to me, anyhow.
Yeah, beautifully put. I mean, fear is an interesting emotion that I guess the more, as you say, the more outward thinking and collaborative we can be, to go back to your points, the stronger we tend to be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are big thoughts in the world, you know, like we all want to change the world, right? And it is utterly important, especially now than ever, that we make a conscious effort to do something whereby the world becomes a better place, right? Yeah. But we all don't have to be heads of states, heads of multi-billion-dollar companies, heads of this, heads of that. Whatever we do, if that impacts like five people, and if that five people impacts another five, and another five, another five, you know, we will do some. You know, it will have an impact. And you talk about risk. That's how you mitigate risk. Mm-hmm. That's how you. How you think about geopolitical risk and socioeconomic risk and whatever, as well as your personal skill risk.
That sounds like a great place to wrap it up, Faisal. Before we go, if people are interested in finding more about you, your books, Where are the best ways to follow you on Twitter?
I'm on the net, as they say. So you can go to my website, personal website, which is faisalhaq.com, or you can go to my company website called shodoka.com. Mm-hmm. You can find me on Twitter, which is faisal_hawk. You can find me on Fast Company. You can find me on Business Insider. You'll be seeing popping up on LinkedIn here and there, so I'm very accessible, and my email address are just like you found. I mean, it's everywhere. So it's
wonderful. I'll put all of that in the show notes, including some of the, you know, the links to your books and the article that you mentioned that Lydia put out today, so people can find you there. I wanted to thank you. This was great. I really really appreciate you coming on the show.
Pleasure, honor.
It was wonderful. So thank you so much.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow, isn't Faisal really interesting? I love his perspective on things. If you also dig Faisal and his stuff, I'll ask you to check out the show notes where you can find out a little bit more about him, all the links to his work and his company and all that good stuff. And if you enjoyed this conversation and you want to hear others that are very similar or like it, please subscribe. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, TuneIn Radio, Spreaker, all kinds of platforms. One thing about iTunes is that the iTunes store can take anywhere from a few hours to a couple of days for my new episodes to update. It's just a thing with iTunes. It happens with all podcasts, apparently. However, if you subscribe on iTunes and refresh your podcast feed, you'll get the latest episodes as soon as they're up. I would finally love to hear from you. If you've got some feedback, you can send it to me. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. You can check out allthingsrisk.com, which is my website, and follow me on Twitter, at riskthings is the handle. That's it for this week, folks. We'll be back with more next week. In the interim, don't forget, risk is life.